Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Copper Bullets, the four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories, is available now.
Zambia was considered as an underdog.
Are we going to do the impossible here?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 18th of June, these are our main stories. The governor of the US state of Maryland has pardoned tens of thousands of people convicted of cannabis offences. A search operation is underway for 30 people after deadly landslides hit a town in central Ecuador. Ukraine have lost to Romania in their opening match at the Euros. Also in this podcast...
The penalty for excessive speeding in Switzerland can be severe, with offenders facing up to 4 years in prison or fined thousands of pounds.
The eye-watering fines awaiting four speeding Brits abroad. The governor of the US state of Maryland has pardoned tens of thousands of people convicted of cannabis offences. Wes Moore told a news conference that his executive order involved over 175,000 convictions. He said black people in Maryland had been three times more likely than their white counterparts to be arrested for cannabis-related offences.
This is a responsibility that I take very, very seriously. And that is why, with deep pride and soberness, I will pardon over 175,000 convictions.
I spoke to the BBC's correspondent in Washington, Nomia Iqbal, who told us how significant this pardoning is.
The governor, Wes Moore's pardons, they include more than 150,000 misdemeanor convictions for the possession of cannabis, and they also involve more than 18,000 misdemeanor convictions for use of drug paraphernalia or possession with intent to use such items. So it's pretty sweeping and historic in terms of what he's done.
And what did Wes Moore say about the reasons for doing it?
He said it's a step to heal decades of social and economic injustice that disproportionately harms black and brown people. And Mr. Moore said that these criminal records have basically been used to deny housing, employment, education, and they've essentially been holding people and their families back long after the sentences were served. So his point is that these policies have been intentionally deployed to hold back entire communities. And he said that, to quote him, he was ecstatic to right these wrongs. It's worth emphasising that the pardons will not result in anyone being released from jail.
To what extent is marijuana and its legalisation a political issue at a federal level?
It's really interesting because in this year's State of the Union address, President Biden did say no one should be jailed for using or possessing marijuana. And his administration has said they want to move forward with a plan to ease federal restrictions and basically reclassify the drug and unlock new voters, young voters. Donald Trump's an interesting one because he hasn't shown many signs, really, of wanting to engage with federal marijuana policy. He did once say he supports medical marijuana. He wants states to set their own laws. And there was a poll last year by Gallup which found that 70% of the country support recreational legislation, whereas Republican voters are the one demographic group who are still sharply split on full legalisation. It's pretty much down the middle. So that might be why we haven't heard much from Donald Trump. But as I mentioned, President Biden has talked about making this an issue as we go forward in the election to try and tap in, presumably, into those younger voters.
Nomia Iqbal. Next to Ecuador, and rescue workers and volunteers in the country have been looking for survivors of Sunday's landslides, which have killed at least six people. The rescue efforts are concentrated in the central town of Baños de Agua Santa. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, explains.
30 people have been reported missing in the area affected by the biggest landslide. Dozens of families have been evacuated to improvised shelters. The landslides were triggered by heavy rains across central parts of Ecuador over the weekend. The storms have led to the temporary closure of a major private pipeline linking oil-producing areas in Ecuador's Amazon region to the coastline. Power cuts have been reported and school classes have been suspended. The authorities have sent heavy machinery to the region to clear roads that have been blocked by rock and mud.
Leonardo Rocha. The White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby has said that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was left with little choice over his decision to disband Israel's war cabinet. This is after the centrist former general Benny Gantz left the Israeli government. It's thought Mr. Netanyahu will now discuss the conflict in Gaza in ad hoc meetings with his defence minister Yoav Gallant and other relevant officials. With the details, here's our Middle East correspondent John Donison.
The war cabinet was set up days after the October 7th Hamas attack to signal political unity, but that unity is long gone. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is being squeezed from the far right and from the centre. When the opposition figure Benny Gantz quit the war cabinet 8 days ago, saying Mr. Netanyahu had no strategic plan for a post-war Gaza, it lost a relatively moderate voice, someone with vast military experience and a man who had the ear of the Americans. From the far right, the hardline National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who opposes any kind of ceasefire with Hamas, demanded he replace Mr. Gantz on the war cabinet. Prime Minister Netanyahu rejected that idea, choosing instead to dissolve the body altogether. It leaves him with greater personal control over decision-making, but he cuts an increasingly isolated figure. There's discord too with the military. The IDF has continued with a daily tactical military pause on the road leading into Gaza from the Kerem Shalom crossing to allow more humanitarian aid in, even though Mr. Netanyahu had publicly called the decision unacceptable. Aid agencies in Gaza have welcomed the pause, but say it is yet to make any difference on the ground.
John Donison in Jerusalem. Well, Simcha Rothman is a member of the Knesset for the far-right National Religious Party, which is in Prime Minister Netanyahu's ruling coalition. Now, well, Al Magafi asked him what he made of Netanyahu's decision.
The rule in Israel is that there is no such a thing as a war cabinet. So there is a cabinet that have all the decision-making power in issues of war and issues of foreign affairs. And this is the security cabinet. And because there were parts of coalition, namely Gantz party, that came into the coalition and they said, we don't want to be involved in the government. We just came to help with the war. That was their claim. So there was a new creation called a war cabinet for them. They left the coalition. There is no need for this war cabinet. And all the decision-making power is back into the regular security cabinet in which my head of party, Bezalel Smotrich, is a member.
I mean, from what I understand, there is a 14-member security cabinet, which your party leader is a part of, but also there will be something called a smaller consultation forum. At least that's what we've read and Haaretz is reporting on today. And he will not be a part of this forum. And one presumes that this is where the serious conversations and decisions are going to be made.
It's always been, especially when you have a group of 14 people, but you have different consultation groups. It's not illegal to consult, not for the prime minister and not for the foreign affairs ministers, to consult with in every group he sees fit. Even during the time that there were war cabinets, of course, me and my party leader, Bezalel Smotrich, we were in close contact with prime minister and with the minister of defense. And there were issues that we consulted with them or argued with them. Some people try to make a lot of fuss about nothing.
So you're saying, you know, not much has changed. Have you been happy with how the war has played out? And do you feel like your party was always being heard by the war cabinet?
No, I did not say it was heard by the war cabinet. I said it was heard by the prime minister and minister of defense on some issues. On some issues, no. And when it was important enough for the public to know our disagreements, we made it public. And most of the times it stayed within the security cabinet or within the consultation group. And what was the most important issue for us as a party, that the war to eliminate Hamas and to get back the hostages will continue. There were offers on the table. Sadly, some of them were coming with pressure from outside to say, basically, finish the war without eliminating Hamas. And for that, we were very strong against. But we see that the war on Hamas continues, and we will make sure that it will continue until Hamas is eliminated.
Simcha Rothman, member of a Knesset for the far-right National Religious Party. A senior American envoy who's tasked with resolving the growing conflict between Israel and the Hezbollah group in Lebanon has been meeting Israeli leaders as concerns grow about an escalation in cross-border attacks. Amos Hochstein is due to travel to the Lebanese capital, Beirut, on Tuesday. His sudden visit to the region follows a sharp rise in hostilities after Israel's assassination of a top Hezbollah commander last week. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has been to that border and sent this report.
Everything is just broken, all the glasses, everything.
Just inside the shattered door of Tom Perry's house is part of the Hezbollah rocket that slammed into it earlier this month. The blast punched large shrapnel holes across the ceiling and walls and blew apart doors and furniture. Tom was out having a beer with friends. His girlfriend was visiting her mother.
This house is not a direct house to Lebanon. You can see there is trees and bushes and houses all around. And we thought there is no rocket that can hit this house, but it happened. So now people understand they are not safe here. It doesn't matter where they live or if they're in their shelter or something. It's not safe here. Just not safe.
Tom Perry's house, perched on Israel's border with Lebanon, is a three-hour drive from where his prime minister met America's special envoy today to try to stop this conflict escalating further. Israel says more than 5,000 explosive missiles have been fired by Hezbollah across its border since the Hamas attacks last October. The US and others say a ceasefire in Gaza is the best way to also end the growing conflict in the north. But Israel's military and political leaders have been talking up the threat of war. That may be part of Israel's practiced strategy of deterrence, but every Hezbollah rocket or Israeli strike carries the risk of a miscalculation that triggers a full-blown war.
Lucy Williamson. Norway is to increase funding for the UN agency UNRWA by $9 million. The organisation was plunged into a financial crisis back in January when many donor countries suspended support in response to Israeli allegations that 12 of its staff took part in the deadly Hamas attack of October the 7th. Most governments have resumed funding after an independent investigation, but the United States has not. The Norwegian Foreign Minister, Espen Barth Eide, said more aid was still needed.
I'm glad to say that we now see that almost all the donors who suspended their support are now back. So the financial situation is better than it could have been if this had continued, but of course still not good, which is why we are now topping up our support.
Espen Barth Eide. Earlier, he warned that the Palestinian Authority could collapse in the coming months due to a lack of international backing and the withholding of tax revenues by Israel. Monday marked the official start of campaigning for the snap general election in France. It was called by President Emmanuel Macron after his Renaissance Party lost heavily to the anti-immigration national rally in the recent EU parliamentary polls. Voting will take place over two Sundays, with the first round on the 30th of June. Mr. Macron is seeking to portray rival alliances on both the right and the left as being dominated by extremists. Our correspondent Hugh Schofield has more from Paris.
Obviously, the question on everyone's minds is it possible for France to have a far-right government 3 weeks from now? A national rally did so well in the European elections. If repeated at the legislative elections, could that lead to a national rally far-right prime minister in the form of Jordan Bardella? It's possible. But it's far from a given that the fact being that the European elections are very different from in their structure from the legislative elections. And even if the National Rally did get a very high score again, say 32%, 33%, 34% of the overall population, that would not necessarily translate into a majority in Parliament. So we'll have to see. The arithmetic of it all is very, very complicated. You know, there are 577 constituencies. There's the centrist bloc, the left wing now, united, presenting only one candidate in each constituency. So they are counting on doing, you know, much better than they might have hoped. And we'll just have to see that after the first round, we should have give a clearer picture, because then we'll be able to see which of the two, in most constituencies, the two front runners who qualify for the runoff. And there we'll be able to make closer predictions about what's going to happen.
Hugh Schofield. Still to come.
People are frustrated that despite having these incredible, record-breaking tourism numbers, a third of the population is still at a risk of poverty and social exclusion.
With the end of the COVID pandemic, foreign travel is on the increase, leading to so-called over-tourism.
Seventeen members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast. It has been a disheartening day for the Ukrainian football team in their first major tournament since the Russian invasion. Ukraine lost 3-0 to Romania. The Ukrainian football commentator Vladimir Zverov told us that winning wasn't everything for his team.
This is a very disappointing game from the Ukraine, but for me personally, this European Championship is not a question about the result on the pitch, but a question result of how Ukraine can talk with the Europe again and showing what's happening with our country through the football, through the voices of our media person.
I heard more from our sports correspondent, John Bennett.
Hugely disappointing for the Ukraine fans after all the build-up to their team playing at this tournament against all the odds. Romania are a good side. We have to remember that. They were unbeaten in qualifying, that they're in good form. So, of course, Ukraine knew it was going to be tough, but I think it's not the defeat that has let the fans down. It was the manner of the performance, really underwhelming, lack of intensity, lack of urgency, not what you've come to expect from this team. And the manager, Serhii Rebrov, has said the performance was really unexpected. He was surprised by the poor performance.
John, I gather they've been trying to highlight the war in Ukraine, the team, throughout this tournament. How have they been doing that?
Yeah, there was a section of seating from a stadium in war-torn Kharkiv that was installed in the stadium in Munich hours before Ukraine took to the field for this opening match. Andrei Shevchenko, legendary player, the country's all-time top scorer. He's now the president of the Ukraine Football Association. He was there to unveil this exhibition. But I think the most striking moment of the tournament so far involving Ukraine was a social media video released by the Football Association a few days ago. All the players talking about how each of their hometowns are being affected by the war.
John Bennett. President Putin will make a two-day visit to North Korea from Tuesday, cementing improved relations between Moscow and Pyongyang. North Korea has been accused of supplying arms and ammunition to Russia in support of its war in Ukraine. Moscow is thought to be giving North Korea food and help with its weapons programs. Last year, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un visited Russia. James Kumarasamy spoke to Soo Kim, former CIA analyst on North Korea, who's based in Washington, and asked her how significant is this visit by the Russian president.
This is the first time in 24 years that the Russian leader is paying a visit to North Korea. And we know that the two countries have been, you know, it's a mutually beneficial relationship. What is important now, I think, is, of course, the atmospherics of geopolitics with the war going on. And alarmingly so, because North Korea is also bent on developing and advancing its weapons program. The atmosphere is such that both countries and both leaders are viewing each other, of course, as friends on the outside, but also as complicit partners in furthering and strengthening their cooperation. So at the end of this visit, of course, the atmospheres are going to remain pretty much the same on the outside. But what we are concerned about is, of course, the fact that these two countries are able to communicate and also collaborate on areas where we are concerned about proliferation. We're concerned about destabilization in the region, not just in Eastern Europe, but also in East Asia, where it's a tinderbox of potential provocations and instability. So all in all, it's going to be an alarm for the United States and other countries in the region that are concerned.
Well, what about the big player in the region, China? How does it view this warming of ties between Russia and North Korea?
One would think that the alignment of Russia's Putin and North Korea's Kim would be concerning to Xi Jinping, because typically when we look at the relationship in North Korea and China, we typically think of China to be North Korea's number one go-to partner. I still think that that's true, and North Korea still looks to China as its economic sponsor. I don't think that is going to change. I also think that, you know, those three countries, Russia, North Korea, China, they're all in this symbiotic relationship. And the relationship is such that, let's say that we do envision, we see greater and further cooperation between North Korea and Russia. Is that going to come at the deficit of North Korea's relationship with China, where North Korea depends on Beijing economically? Unclear if that's if North Korea is willing to take it that far. And also, I think the three leaders would be cognizant of the dynamics in the region as well.
Soo Kim, former CIA analyst on North Korea. China has launched an investigation into pork products from the European Union in what appears to be a tit-for-tat action. Last week, the EU decided to impose tariffs of up to 40% on Chinese electric vehicles. The investigation into EU pork could result in Beijing imposing its own tariffs. A spokesman for the European Commission, Olaf Gill, said they would be closely monitoring the situation.
The Commission takes note of the decision by the government of China to initiate an anti-dumping investigation on European imports of pork and swine byproducts. The Commission is now analysing the application. We will follow the proceedings very closely in coordination with EU industry and our member states, and we will intervene as appropriate to ensure that the investigation fully complies with all relevant World Trade Organization rules.
Ava Goksik covers the pork and beef sectors in Europe for Rabobank. Roger Hearing asked her first about the size of the EU's pork trade with China.
China is actually the single biggest market for EU pork, representing over about 30% of total EU pork exports. So, yeah, we are quite reliant on China.
Yeah, I understand about $3 billion worth, pretty much, which is pretty huge.
Yes, yeah, it's huge. Although our dependency decreased over the past 2-3 years. So it's peaked in 2020 when our dependency was around 55-60%, because China was demanding more pork as they were just recovering from the African swine fever outbreaks. But now, yeah, it's still a significant market.
And if there were some tariffs put on EU pork, how would that affect the trade?
Higher tariffs would or could actually deteriorate further the competitive position of the EU. We already see quite high prices in the EU for pork relative to other exporters such as US and Brazil. That is because our supply declined over the past 2 years. So if competitive position is affected, then also price levels, margins in the European pork supply chains can be affected as well.
So Europe might lose market share, in other words?
Yes, that's right.
And that would be very damaging, I guess, to many European economies. Which economies within Europe would be most vulnerable?
Well, if we are looking at the biggest exporters of pork in Europe, that would be Spain. And also they are supplying most of the products to China. And also the Netherlands, Denmark, France, those are also big exporters with large exposure to China.
Now, of course, talking of tariffs reminds us that, in fact, Europe has decided to impose tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles. Is this being seen as a tit for tat, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think so. I do think that's the kind of the reason for this investigation.
Because what the Chinese say is that they have complaints from their own domestic producers of pork that this is unfair competition, but you don't think that necessarily is true?
I don't think so, because China is reliant on imports, on pork imports, because they have a self-sufficiency about 95%. So they are still relying on pork imports, and they are importing from Brazil, from US. Europe actually is their biggest supplier. But when you look at prices in Europe, those are quite high, and they are still importing products from the EU. And I don't think that we can go below our cost price levels, because it just wouldn't make sense for European exporters to sell cheaper than our production costs.
Eva Goksik from Rabobank. The 85-year-old British actor Ian McKellen is being treated in hospital after falling off stage during a performance in London's West End on Monday evening. He's one of the world's most distinguished Shakespearean actors and a movie star thanks to his role as Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings. Our correspondent Chichi Izundu has more details.
So Ian McKellen was taking part in a duelling scene when he lost his footing and fell off the front of the stage. A BBC journalist who was sat in the audience said the actor could be heard crying out in pain before the house lights came up and staff rushed towards him. The audience was then evacuated from the theatre and the rest of the performance was cancelled. Outside, theatre staff used boards and umbrellas to block the public's view as Sir Ian was moved to a waiting ambulance. His agent has confirmed he is being treated in hospital. The extent of his injuries are not known yet. Sir Ian McKellen is one of the UK's most eminent actors, with a career spanning more than six decades on stage and on screen. He's best known for his numerous Shakespeare roles, as well as playing Gandalf in The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Chichi Izundu. Since the end of the COVID pandemic, tourism has again increased around the world. But now, from Barcelona to Bali, higher fees and new rules are targeting what's seen as the uncontrolled influx of tourism to many of the world's hotspots. Tourism is, of course, big business for hotels, restaurants and airlines. But many locals in these areas feel economically left out, and that the rapid surge has gone too far. Ed Butler has been exploring the perceived problem of what's now called over-tourism.
The sound of protests in Tenerife, in the Canary Islands, in mid-April. Local men and women blowing conches, carrying banners.
I am incredibly moved by how many people actually came out on that day.
This is Sharon Backhouse. She's a British-born businesswoman who runs Geo Tenerife. It's a travel and research company on the island.
I was there on the ground, and there was people from all walks of life, and the mood was extraordinary. Hundreds of thousands of people on the streets demonstrating, six people on hunger strike for 20 days. And one of the main things they're saying is, please put a stop to any more hotel developments until we can implement a model that is equally good for locals and not just foreign investors.
What we hope is that the demonstration will be historic. We're convinced it will be. The people are finally raising their voices. They're not going to stay at home.
People are frustrated that despite having these incredible, record-breaking tourism numbers, a third of the population is still at a risk of poverty and social exclusion. And what locals are saying is, look, we welcome tourism, we have for a long time, and we will continue to do so. But the locals have to be prime beneficiaries too.
Tenerife is not the first place to see such protests. Over-tourism, as it's known, the influx of camera-toting visitors into small areas of natural beauty, is being seen as a growing problem. They've prompted outcry in Machu Picchu in Peru, on Bali's sacred mountain, and from Egypt's pyramids to Mount Fuji in Japan. There, in one town, they've put up a wall to block the view of the mountain to deter the relentless photography.
We welcome foreigners for this revitalization of the community, but there are so many violations of basic manners, like jaywalking, dumping garbage, trespassing on people's property. I wish they'd pay more attention to that.
European cities, with their record-breaking visitor numbers, have become the epicentre of a growing anti-tourist sentiment now. Coco Inns is a professor of new urban tourism at In Holland University in the Netherlands.
First of all, there's the numbers of tourists. So many people on the streets. You can't move freely anymore. People drinking too much, being rowdy and that sort of thing. And then places have become more and more suitable for tourists rather than for residents. And in city centres you can see local supermarkets or local bakeries or other local facilities not being able to afford to rent anymore because there are tourist shops now.
Most tourist hotspots, of course, seek the economic benefits, but they are also coming up with different ideas to solve the excesses. Take Venice, which last month became the first city to charge tourists coming on day trips to enter the city. Simone Venturini is the city's deputy mayor for tourism.
Right now, Venice is trying to restart better than before. We just want less tourism in terms of quantity, and we want higher tourism in terms of quality. Not only to take a selfie in 3 hours and then go home, because this is not the right tourist for the city of Venice.
The issue of taxation is an interesting one because it's a relatively easy thing to do. But again, you need to be careful to only talk about the economic benefits. The economic benefits of tourism are relatively limited to a set number of stakeholders, people who work in tourism or who own a business. But most people do not fall into that category, whereas the disadvantages are felt by a much larger group of people.
Professor Coco Inns. The fact is, though, that for all of these ideas to reduce over tourism, current projections suggest that global travel is going to carry on rising for the foreseeable future.
That report by Ed Butler. Now, how much would you expect to pay out as a fine if you were caught speeding? $50 maybe? Perhaps a couple of hundred if you were going particularly fast. Well, not in Switzerland. You could be seriously bankrupted there. And four English tourists who Swiss police say were caught driving at more than 200 kilometres an hour are likely to have a very nasty shock in store. Nikki Cardwell has more details.
The penalty for excessive speeding in Switzerland can be severe, with offenders facing up to 4 years in prison or fined thousands of pounds. Cars can be confiscated, and a judge may deem that they should be sold or even scrapped. In a previous case, a man caught driving his Porsche at 135 kilometres per hour through a village was fined $290,000. Zurich police say these men from England were arrested and their cars impounded after motorists reported seeing four vehicles being driven at extremely high speeds. All four were driving what the police described as expensive sports cars. The speed limit on Swiss motorways is 120 kilometres per hour. Officers believe they were doing more than 200, which pushes the offence into a more serious category. They're also investigating whether the cars were racing. The men are believed to still be in custody. When they're released, they'll be allowed to return home while a judge decides their fate and that of their cars.
Nikki Cardwell. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Seventeen members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.